And that brings me to today's guest, Kashmir Hill. She's an investigative reporter at Gizmodo. She's a really, really great tech reporter. I've been following her work for years. I think, as you'll hear in our conversation, she really distinguished her reporting early on for being, I think, far more skeptical of the claims of Silicon Valley than many of the other people reporting on those same companies, particularly during some of the frothiest years of rah-rah cheerleaderism for the way that Silicon Valley was going to transform the world and be the future of American society. We're now in a much different place, I think, in the way that we think about those companies and about the effects of their products, but she was ahead of the curve on that. And she undertook this deceptively simple project at Gizmodo. And the deceptively simple project was like, I'm just going to give up this stuff. I'm just going to not use it. What happens? That's it. That's the full thing. And she spun out this incredible reporting project based on that just deceptively simple premise, which, as you will hear, is astoundingly harder than that simple articulation of it is. I am not going to use this stuff. Let's see what happens to my life when I step back from some of the biggest tech companies in our lives. Like our conversation with Stacy Mitchell about Amazon, you're going to learn a lot about just how ubiquitous big tech is in our lives.
You've been a tech reporter for a while, right?
It has been a decade, I think. Maybe a little bit more than a decade. I wasn't a tech reporter when I started, so I don't know when I morphed into a tech reporter, but somewhere along the way, people started putting me on tech list.
And then you've been reporting about Silicon Valley and tech for a while. It seems to me like tech reporting has changed a ton, particularly recently. And as someone who's been a practitioner for a little while, what do you think has changed?
I think other tech reporters are more like me now. I really did not come from a tech reporting background. I was at a legal blog called Above the Law. My background was in law, and I got interested in privacy, and I was writing about privacy and law. And I kind of just backed into technology because I was writing about how our privacy was changing in the modern world, and it forced me to start writing about, you know, cookies and tracking and all these new technologies that were being developed to track us. And so I would say I came into writing about technology from a more critical perspective in terms of how it was invading privacy, as opposed to being a person that was kind of covering the business of tech or covering amazing new gadgets. And I think people who came from that perspective tended to be more enthralled of the tech industry and like amazed by all the incredible new things it was doing and bringing into the world and making possible. And now I think there's been a shift. And those reporters and those publications are far more critical of the tech giants now. And there's more of a backlash in tech reporting. So I would say that overall it's become more negative. But I'm proud to say I was always pretty negative.
You've been a hater from day one is what you're trying to say.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think that's the reason that your work first stood out to me was for that reason. I started reading you on privacy when you were writing about privacy back in Above the Law. And your work has been critical and clear-eyed in a way that a lot of tech reporting was not, but more is now. To what do you attribute the change?
One, I think that these companies, and it's part of what my series touches on, have just become so much more powerful. And they're not little startups anymore.
Yeah.
Google used to do amazing searches. Amazon made it easier to buy things online. Facebook helped us figure out who else in our class was hot and asked them out. And now these companies do so much more. Like Amazon is powering the backbone of the web. Google is all over the internet. Like you can't go around online without running into something Google. They control all the mapping technology essentially that's used online. And Facebook bought Instagram and bought WhatsApp and controls most of the social media that we consume. It's where, you know, all of our friends are living online. And so one, they've just gotten to be bigger players that I think attract more criticism, and they're starting to have real effects on how we live. And some of those things are very negative. I mean, honestly, sometimes I think they get outsized attention or blame for things that are happening in society, but they do play huge roles in our everyday life now. And I think that, yeah, has engendered some criticism.
Yeah. So the ubiquity, the size of the scope and the power, and then also to me, I think finding out what's underneath the hood is a big part of it, that you have the sense that I'm interacting with this thing and I'm writing an email and my understanding of my interaction with Gmail is like, they make a free software product. I use it. Okay, I kick them $5 a year or whatever for some storage. But that's not where the relationship ends. They're learning lots of things about me, everything about me. They're reading all of my words, and they're using that to make money by essentially selling it. And I think, to me, speaking for myself, the reality of that as a business model was much less clear to me, say, 3 or 4 years ago than it is now.
Right. Maybe people understand the price we're actually paying online now. What's more disturbing is that I think other players looked at these tech giants and said, wow, they're making so much money just off of people's data. You know, we should start doing that too.
Right.
And so you see things that we pay for, like our phone carriers, they're collecting data about our location and what we're looking at on our phone. And they started packaging that up and they anonymize it and aggregate it. And then they sell that. So even something you're paying $100 a year for, they're still packaging up your data and selling it. So that's been another kind of harmful effect of the spread of the tech giant's business model.
And this gets to what your project is, right? So describe to me what your undertaking is and how you came up with the idea.
So when you're critical of these companies and you say they're too powerful or they're too privacy invasive, people often will say, oh, well, you know, if you don't like Facebook, don't use its products. If you don't like Google, just get off Gmail. And so I wanted to explore that argument and find out if it's possible not to use a company if you don't like it. And so that was kind of what I was trying to tackle here. And I found out that it's not possible to avoid them, with the exception of Apple. Even if you choose to boycott their products, you're still interacting with them really all the time that you're online and with Microsoft and the rest, really, but in the real world as well. So you can't totally avoid them. The idea actually came to me because, I mean, there's many people that are especially critical of Google. Google has a lot of enemies. And so somebody pitched me on the idea. They're like, Google's so powerful. You should, you know, try to avoid them and write about how hard it is. And I was like, oh, that's actually a good idea, but I want to do it with all the technology companies.
Turns out Amazon pitched you on that story. They're like, you know who's really bad? You know who's really, really bad? So you set out with the project. I mean, I want to just reiterate a thing you just said. You can't choose not to use some of these companies. That's what you're saying. That's what you've concluded.
Yeah, some of these companies are just unavoidable. You have to use them because, or you will encounter them because they're all around the website and you're going to use services that are using their services.
Like, to live in the modern world is to use Amazon, for instance.
Yes.
And Google.
Yes.
So tell me what you did. So you've got Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Apple, and Facebook, right?
Yes.
So those are the big five. Okay. So you
set... A lot of people are mad at me because every time I would tweet one of these stories, they're like, well, what about Twitter? But I was trying to just stick to kind of like the really big five, the companies that people sometimes call the frightful five.
Well, and I also, don't you also think that Twitter, in some ways, doing the experiment of Twitter, I think would prove out the point, which is that you can cut Twitter out of your life.
Yeah. Like, you probably will run into, you know, the tweet button around the web, but I think it would be pretty easy.
I mean, you'll run
maybe
into people
to cut out
yes,
of my
but,
life.
Oh, my God. Would it be healthy? You'll run into people reading the president's tweets like on the television. But from a tech standpoint, I mean, so you say, okay, I'm going to go through this sequence of cutting these out. You start with Amazon. So my surface thought was like, OK, not ordering anything from Amazon. OK. Yeah. Sort of inconvenient. But that's the tip of the iceberg, right? Like, how did you go about doing this to make sure you were 100% cut off from Amazon?
Right. I didn't want to just boycott their products, in part because, you know, journalists have done that before. They've stopped using Facebook, they stopped using Google, and they write about how hard it is. But I wanted to really cut myself off from them, in part to, you know, make it a more interesting stunt, but also to really understand how often I was encountering them in invisible ways, which I knew was happening because I write about the technology industry. So I worked with a technologist named Dhruv Mehrotra, and I wasn't sure exactly how to do this. I went to him and I said, hey, I want to cut the tech giants out of my life completely. I don't want to interact with them at all. How do I do it? And he went and did some research and came back to me and said, oh, hey, all the technology giants publish these lists of all the IP addresses, the internet protocol addresses that they control. So I could build something for you that would just prevent your devices from being able to interact with those IP addresses to send anything to them or receive anything from them. And that way I would just cut you off entirely from these companies' servers. So it means that Google's analytics on a page just wouldn't be able to load. Facebook's like button just wouldn't appear there. And any website that was hosted by one of these companies, which turned out most of the time to be AWS or Amazon Web Services, it just wouldn't load.
So this is the first thing I found shocking and hadn't even thought of is the sheer amount of just web traffic and IP addresses controlled by these companies. It's enormous.
Yeah, it's really big. I mean, what was fun about the story is I love any story that dives into how the internet works. I think most of us just kind of think about it as this like invisible vapor around us that, you know, you click on an app or type in a URL and then just information is there. So I always think it's fun to dive into all the, I mean, the internet's a strange place with all these standards bodies. And so anyways, Dhruv did this research for me and said, you know, Amazon and Microsoft control over 20 million IP addresses. Google had about 9 million, which I was kind of surprised by that it was a bit of a laggard there. Mm-hmm. Facebook had only 122,000 or something, a very small amount of IP addresses. And then Apple had a bunch. I think they were around 16 million. And this is just like the number of IP addresses that they own. They're kind of squatting on them. And sometimes IP addresses, you know, attach to a device on the internet, but it just gives them a way to roll out services and have a place for your internet traffic to go to get to them.
Yeah. So I guess I'm sort of debating in my head how in the weeds of this to get, because I will confess that I have no idea how the internet works. I mean, I really don't understand. It is basically magic. And there's like stuff floating around the air. There's like how many bars I have on my phone. And then it's like, boop, doop, doop, boop, 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 and it just like beams in. I know there are servers. I know there are networks. I know an IP address is a unique locator and that traffic goes in packets and hops from these sort of noted clusters from place to place and moves over these wires. But that's it. Like, I don't. So when you say in the first one, you start to block all the Amazon IP addresses, my question is like, what are they? What does that mean? What can't you see?
So I think the easiest way to think about it is those IP addresses, think of them as directions. Like IP addresses are directions to Amazon's server. Mm-hmm. And so every time my devices wanted to direct themselves towards Amazon servers, Dhruv's blocker said, nope, you can't go this way.
And that happened a lot.
It happened a lot. We did run into one little problem, and this is, again, how the internet works. Amazon AWS servers are like huge servers that have all this data. And then sometimes a company wants its website to load faster. So they'll have a secondary service called a content delivery network or CDN. And these are companies that have like a whole bunch of little servers that are more prolific. And so when you load a website, sometimes it'll get the information from that CDN, those little machines who are storing it from the big machines from Amazon. And it just means that you don't have to wait for the, you know, the data packets to come all the way from the Amazon warehouse. You can get it from the smaller warehouse that's closer to your device. And so if we saw that CDN, we wouldn't realize it was coming from Amazon. So sometimes it messed up our blocker.
Right. So just to go back. So you set up a VPN, your tech dude sets up a VPN. It says for week one, no Amazon IP addresses. One of the first things you learn is actually even that doesn't fully screen on Amazon because there's this sort of small retail outfits whose back ends are actually Amazon, but don't look like Amazon to the VPN. So they're getting through. So you got to try to figure that out. What else are you starting to deal with in week one of no Amazon?
So just websites not working. And, you know, I'm a journalist and I was trying to do work this week. And so, you know, I tried to go, every government website stopped working for me because they all use AWS.
Every government website.
Every government website that I tried to use. I didn't try all the government websites, but I was doing some research that took me to a few of them. Journalism websites went down. I'm using this car rental service right now called Drive Canvas, and its website stopped working, so I couldn't like go see my bills. Some of my apps stopped working. I went for a run. I couldn't record the run on Runkeeper because it used AWS in some way.
Wow.
But the bigger problem was that it cut off all digital entertainment for me because all video streaming sites use AWS, even Netflix, which is a big Amazon competitor.
You mentioned that in the piece, but I thought I was misunderstanding because I thought you were just, it's so funny, I thought you were just like a real Amazon Prime home for some reason and just super loyal to Amazon Prime. And so you cut off Amazon Prime. I was like, well, we can't watch anything. But what you're saying is literally everything streams through the AWS backend, no matter what you're streaming it over.
Pretty much. I mean, in my experience, HBO Go was down, Netflix was down, Hulu was down. AWS, it's kind of
incredible. That's crazy.
It's crazy. And then I think we could have listened to Spotify because Spotify is hosted by Google, except we listened to Spotify through our Amazon Echo, which I had to put away in a drawer. So, yeah, so we just had a very silent house. But, yeah, it's insane. Like, Amazon recognized about a decade ago that web hosting was an important business. I think they're finding it with their own business. They developed this solution and then they released it to the world. And AWS is now the most profitable part of Amazon, not its retail. Tons of people use them. They just have, I guess, a great service. Even their competitors are relying on them to host their movies and their data.
I mean, the implications here are kind of crazy because Amazon's Prime Video is this big play they're making to compete with Netflix. You can imagine a world in which they're like, oh, look at that. Would you look at that? We had a little glitch and the Netflix streaming went out. Like, I mean, they're clearly not doing that now. I think if they were, we would know about it. But it's a little weird that that is a possibility.
I know. What's hilarious is actually whenever we watch Amazon Prime Video, the streaming quality is terrible. And I'm like, what? They need to get
that is ironic,
lessons from
actually.
Netflix.
So you cut out your entertainment. You cut out a million websites. My big takeaway from the Amazon week for you was you cut out ordering stuff from them, which was a little bit of a pain. There's a great story about how you order something on eBay and it comes out in an Amazon package.
Amazon is so dominant in the kind of the storage and shipping industry that they have something called Fulfillment by Amazon. A lot of people that use competitors still use Amazon for storage and shipping. So I ordered from eBay, but it came from Amazon in an Amazon package.
And there's a funny part, you eat some Whole Foods sushi, which you only realize after you put it in your mouth. But it seemed to me that when you divide up that Amazon week, the ordering stuff and the Whole Foods and stuff is live withoutable. It's the architecture of the back end of the internet that is not.
Right. Which I kind of knew. I knew AWS was big. I didn't realize how big it was. And I found that a lot of people reading the story didn't know about Amazon Web Services because it's invisible to you as you're navigating the web. You don't, I've had a lot of people I talked to during the series compare it to the environmental movement or like the food movement, the slow food movement, and being digital vegans who are really careful about where their data comes from. But I think most people are just using the internet, aren't thinking about where the data is coming from. And I don't know, maybe that'll change, but it was really interesting for me to be able to see this because I type in a website and it just won't load.
So what was the next hardest one to cut out?
I think the next hardest was probably Google.
Yeah.
I mean, Google does do cloud hosting as well, though they're not nearly as popular as AWS. But it was more that Google was really on like all the sites that I went to and a lot of apps. It's just that Google provides services that are used across the web. So, for example, I ran into on tons of sites something called Google Fonts. And I could see that the website was like trying desperately to load Google Fonts. And I'm like, what the hell is Google Fonts? I've never heard of this before. It's a repository that they released around the time that they released Google Chrome that will automatically populate your browser with a whole bunch of font options so that a website doesn't have to get the font from your computer and then figure out a different font if your computer doesn't have it stored. So lots of sites use it.
Turns out the entire internet is in Comic Sans. Without Google Fonts, like every page you load.
Man, that would be great for getting people to use the internet less.
So Google Fonts, which you as a tech reporter didn't know the product existed.
I didn't. You know, Google says they don't use it to track anybody. They have it in a kind of an FAQ somewhere. But still, it means that, I mean, any site that has Google Fonts, like you're interacting with Google's server and there's some information about you that's kind of being sent to them. It could be really basic and it doesn't sound like they use it, but I was just surprised to have it there. on top of, I mean, tons of other stuff like Google Ads, Google Analytics, just random Google trackers, and then Google Maps are everywhere.
Yeah, that was the striking thing to me, was that Google Maps really are the backbone of geolocation. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. Absolutely. I tried to pull up stats on this, and they didn't seem to exist in the same way that stats exist for other categories. But I basically looked at websites that look at the elements in various, you know, maps and apps. And it was something like 80% or more of maps are powered by Google or by the Google Maps API, which is just quite a monopoly on the market. And the way that this manifested for me is that, you know, one morning I needed to get to a meeting and I was planning on Ubering there or Lyfting there, but neither app would work for me. And I'm like, what is going on? I just couldn't enter the destination. And it turned out that they were non-operational without being able to access Google Maps. I just couldn't even enter a destination.
Yeah, you opt out of Google, you basically opt out of GPS functionally, which is what I learned from your reporting, which I did not know. And is it, again,
I don't know. I wouldn't say you opt out of GPS. Like, my iPhone still knows where I
your iPhone does.
Where
okay.
I am.
But individual yeah, but apps like or other things that are using the API. What is an API?
Right, like, it's like an automated way for computers to interact with a database and, like, pull right. information out of it.
Right.
I was really surprised because I don't know how much if your listeners would know, but Yelp is like a very big critic and enemy of Google because they've been so mad about the way that Google prioritizes its own listings above Yelp. So they've
yes.
been kind of like in an antitrust battle for a long time. But when I went to Yelp.com to find a restaurant to go to for lunch one day, its map wouldn't load because it was using Google Maps.
From the sort of internet infrastructural standpoint, Google and Amazon are near the top. Now, I thought Microsoft was interesting in its inclusion because I think of Microsoft, I associate Microsoft with my childhood. I think of Microsoft in the same category as like Sega Genesis. It's a thing. It really was of the moment at a certain point in my life. And then I stopped thinking about Microsoft as a big tech player. I think stopped thinking of Microsoft as being totally dominant, which in my youth they were. There was a big antitrust case against them. Bill Gates was famously the richest man in the world, yada, yada, yada. But Microsoft is still an enormous player.
Yeah, we don't like, we think, oh, Microsoft's not cool anymore. But it's huge. I mean, it's constantly in competition for most valuable public company in the world. Of course, they make the Xbox, which is, I think, kind of cool. They make the workhorses of social media, or they own them, GitHub, LinkedIn, and Skype, which Skype I use quite a lot. They do that stuff that we traditionally associate with them, which is like Windows servers and Windows Office and Outlook. Those things are definitely still around and making the company a lot of money. You know, I thought it would be really easy to get off Microsoft products. And it was as a consumer, but I just kind of started to notice when I was out and about, every time I went to a coffee shop, I was like, oh, this could very well be their point of sale system is probably run on a Microsoft server. And I was on BART, which is the subway in San Francisco. And I was like, this is probably run on Microsoft. And I got into my car one day and I looked down and it's a Ford Fusion 2015. And on the center console, which I'd never noticed before, was Sync powered by Microsoft.
Right.
So Microsoft was powering, you know, this entertainment navigation system in my car. So even though we don't think of, they're not like a super like consumer happy brand where we are thinking about, oh, we're using Microsoft all the time, but they are still embedded in the infrastructure of our cities and in lots of governments, probably because our technology is kind of dated, are definitely still reliant on Microsoft.
We work off of Microsoft workstations every day at the office. So I would, although I would be, it would be a blissful release if I didn't have to do that. I really don't like my Windows machine. Sorry, tech, if you're listening, sorry. So Apple was the easiest, you say?
So Apple was emotionally difficult for me because
your phone.
My phone, my laptop, my work laptop. I mean, Apple is kind of like my portal to all things digital. And I became an Apple user maybe like 6 years ago. And once you become an Apple user, you're just kind of like trapped in their ecosystem.
Oh, my God.
All I won't use a curse word here, but their ports, just the constantly changing ports and like, oh, sorry, we're not going to have a headphone jack anymore. I'm like, come on, Apple, what is the matter with
it
you?
It is a dysfunctional relationship in my life where I got into this relationship with Apple. I liked their computers way more than I liked Windows. One of the reasons I got into it, because iTunes and the early iPhone, which I had, you could sync music much more easily. And then as the years have gone by, it's become less and less usable. The products have gotten less and less usable. I mean, I do not have the IQ to work iTunes. Like, I just don't. I don't get it. I don't understand it anymore. It makes me feel like a complete out of it old man because I don't understand the interface of iTunes. And I generally feel frustrated with Apple products a fair amount, but there's no getting out. I can't get out.
Yeah.
Like, I got the ports and I've got everything, got the account and like everything synced up in this one way. And then I'm just stuck there. And they know that. And they know that. So they don't work to make it any better.
Yeah. We were Marie Kondoing our house and we just have like 1,000 different Apple cords. I'm like, do we even have a computer to go with this particular cord at this point? And it's also that Apple, I'm going to generalize a little bit, but like, they make privacy and security easier.
Yes.
And so that keeps me there. And it's something I pay more for their products just for that kind of like easy privacy security that's kind of just built into it. And it was just like hard to get used to non-Apple products because I hadn't used them in so long. But once I did get used to them, it wasn't that hard being away from Apple. And I didn't encounter them anymore. Like Apple, if you don't use an Apple product, Apple doesn't track you.
See, this is...
They're not trying to collect data about you.
Kara Swisher and I did an interview with Tim Cook. And it got a lot of news because he was pretty critical of Mark Zuckerberg, who we'll talk about in a second, and Facebook. But he made that point. Look, we made a decision that we sell you products. We engineer products. We sell you those products. We want you to purchase those products. That's how we make our money. And we don't sell your data. That's not the business that we're in. And we want you to have privacy and security. And by and large, relative to the other companies, that's true. But the other thing that I found insidious was your discovery in that week, which is because of that, even though it was emotionally hard to give up, they were the easiest one to avoid because they have made that decision.
Right. Like Apple, because they've made that decision and Apple's basically not trying to sell products to non-Apple users. Which is, it's part of the walled garden. It's part of what's kind of frustrating about them. But yeah, they're just not trying to like reach across the divide. So yeah, they're not trying to collect your data. I mean, they did for a while have iAds, which doesn't fit easily into Cook's narrative, but they abandoned that, I think, because it wasn't doing that well. But yes, it allowed them to just go the way of, we just sell you hardware.
It's really interesting.
Their kind of privacy promises are... they seem reliable.
Right. But to me, it's the ultimate illustration of the perverse incentives. Because if you make those reliable, I mean, I guess it's not because Apple is one of the most profitable companies in the world. So, you know, it's not like they're suffering. But, right, I mean, they've made a bet that we're going to make superior products and people will pay for that. But the idea that their ubiquity is less because they've made that choice is a little unnerving because it makes me think that the incentives are for ubiquity and selling people's data and using their data and running things behind the scenes. And if those are the incentives, that's what we're going to get more of.
Well, I guess there's that lesson. I think the other lesson is, well, whether privacy becomes a luxury good. Huh. And, you know, Apple products are expensive products. And part of what you're paying for is that this is a company that's not going to be trying to like monetize you or kind of track you in creepy ways. One of the kind of bigger takeaways from this project was, if we don't want to live in this surveillance economy, maybe we'll have to pay for things online. But that means that privacy will only be afforded to people who are wealthy.
Right.
And people who can't afford it, like the poor, the most vulnerable people in society, will continue to be exploited. So that's problematic to me. Capitalism at work. And that's where you think, oh, maybe the government needs to get involved and regulate this whole thing.
Well, that brings us to Facebook, which in some ways, I think Facebook is the most controversial right now, has had the most negative press. I just think they've handled all of it terribly. I can't tell. What do you think? Is it that what they're doing is indefensible or they've handled it terribly? I don't think I can figure it out.
Which thing? I mean,
the way they are using your data and not regulating their platform, basically.
So one thing I think is weird about Facebook is I just don't think the people who created Facebook ever dreamed of what Facebook would become. And I think all on the way, they have just been kind of haphazardly building this thing, never realizing that one day they would have you know, over a billion people using it, and that they would become like the data intermediary for a good portion of the world. And so I always just feel like they're kind of just like doing things haphazardly and not thinking about the consequences, and that the people who run it just have no idea what the world is like for people who don't look like them.
That seems like a totally accurate diagnosis, but it also seems like the one they, in a weird way, are pushing, because it's more exculpatory than the more nefarious one, which is like, oh, shucks. Oh, darn. We just didn't understand this whole Rohingya thing, and whew, I guess we ate it a genocide. We've got a whole team now working on it, and it's like, that's not good enough.
No.
That's my feeling. That's not good enough. Like, you have the power, and if you can't wield the power has to be taken away from you, because there is concrete evidence your platform is being used literally in the commission of genocide, which is the worst thing that human beings do to each other, and you are implicated in it.
Yeah, I don't think that they were able to foresee that in any way, and I don't think they really know how to fix it.
Yeah. What did you learn when you tried to block them?
So when I tried to block, and yeah, I've long been critical of Facebook, and
I'm the one ranting about blood on their hands. So just to be
yeah, I mean, I just always think about, basically for the last 2 years or more, I've been obsessed with Facebook's People You May Know and how they figure out who we know in real life, mm-hmm. Just because it's so creepy to people. And, you know, one of the things I figured out they were doing is every time you upload your contacts to Facebook, you're basically like outing anybody who's in there, and Facebook takes that information and it layers it on other people's accounts. So, you know, maybe I've only given my Facebook my phone number, but, you know, if you give them my phone number and two email addresses for me, that all gets kind of layered into my account, and they can, by having this like vast black book of the whole world, they can figure out who knows who. And this resulted in sex workers having their identities outed to their clients. I discovered that was happening before I understood the contact thing.
Wow.
And Facebook just wouldn't really engage with me and tell me, like, how is it that sex workers and their clients are being connected through your platform? Like, sex workers use burner phone, burner email address. They have a fake name. Their clients are doing the same thing, and yet you're somehow still making these connections. And Facebook was kind of like, oh, we don't really know how that would happen. They wouldn't be transparent about all that goes into People You May Know that would help people protect themselves against this. And that's what really bothers me so much about Facebook, is that, one, I don't think they sympathize with a sex worker at all. And two, they don't want to be really candid with us about how their platform works. And so it makes it hard for us to protect ourselves against Facebook.
Yeah,
but sorry.
That's exactly the thing that I find maddening about it is, and I'm not trying to single out Facebook as like the most nefarious American company. I think the oil industry takes that crown, but I find them very gaslighty, I guess is what I would say, over the last few years in the wake of this negative press, which is very much like, oh, yeah, no, don't worry, it's the secret sauce. No, we're not doing that. Okay, maybe. Well, yeah, there was actually a lot of that, which feels like the revelation arc and everything, and I just find it a little maddening.
Yeah, I get very frustrated by this company, but I will say, so going off Facebook, they actually didn't track me that much.
Yeah.
That's once I wasn't using Facebook products. So yeah, all this to say all this bad stuff about Facebook. But when it came down to it, in terms of, so we built this VPN that I was using to block myself off from the giants. At the same time we were blocking, we are tracking how often my devices were trying to interact with that giant. And so the week I was blocking Facebook, it was much less. Like, Google tried to interact with my devices over 100,000 times when it was blocked, and Amazon nearly 300,000 times.
Wow.
But with Facebook, it was just 15,000 times, which is not that much. Like, that might have just been me opening the Instagram account a few times by accident. So they do have trackers all over the web. They have Facebook Pixel and the Facebook Like button. Pixel, I think, is the one that causes a lot of anxiety for people, because they'll be on their work computer and they'll be looking at some shoes, and then later they'll be on their phone scrolling through Instagram and they see a ad for those shoes and they're like, how does
that,
it know?
It
must be listening to my conversation.
Yes. People are convinced. By the way, people are convinced that they're listening to your phone. Are they?
No. I mean, I don't think so. We just talked about how you ask Facebook what it's doing and it won't tell you the truth, so who knows?
That is exactly the reality vortex I'm describing, because I've had multiple people like, oh, dude, they're listening to your phone, dude. Like, what are you, a child? How naive are you? I'm like, I don't think they are, or if they are, it hasn't been established or reported, but what the hell do I know?
I did. I'm 88% certain that they're not listening or that no one's listening. I did work with some researchers who tried to study this. Like, they set up a whole bunch of phones with apps that were running all the time, and they're just trying to measure whether the microphone ever got secretly activated by, like, any of these phones, any of these apps. And they discovered other creepy things, of course, but they didn't see any evidence that there's, like, secret microphone activation happening. Though I'm always impressed. There's, like, people that are, I'm always horrified because people are so convinced that their phones are listening, and yet they have it on their bedside table at night while they're, like, having sex, and they take it into the bathroom. And I'm like, if you think your phone's spying on you, maybe you should put it away.
I gotta rack up those likes on my tweet. I gotta see what I tweeted. I gotta see if everyone's liking my tweet. I mean, well, that's part of it. I mean, so to me, there's two aspects to this, a sort of grand takeaways. I mean, my big takeaway is, I don't know if I believe what I'm about to say, but is a possibility. Amazon is a utility that should be nationalized. Like, maybe Google is too. It should not be the case that a private company has that much power or is that intimately woven into the infrastructure of contemporary life.
Yeah, I mean, in the real world, the government, you know, built our roads and to a certain extent, like, powers our transportation system and our airports and, you know, oversees the energy industry is, you know, extremely regulated. The digital world is huge now, right? Like, we spend, oh, it's sad, but I think we spend almost as much time in the digital world as in the real world. There's increasingly the borders between the two are gone. And the digital world, the internet, has been built mostly by these private companies. And right. They control the roads. They built the roads. They control the transportation systems. And I think when you start looking at it that way and you realize the degree to which they've built and controlled the infrastructure of our online environments and our digital environments, I find the argument that they're utilities and should be regulated like utilities pretty powerful.
But that was not my takeaway of, weirdly enough, of your reporting on, like, Facebook and Apple, which are both incredibly present in one's life. And in some ways, the thing we're talking about on the consumer end is our addiction to them. And one of the revelatory things about your reporting is that there's the front-facing consumer side and then there's the back-end side, which you don't know anything about. And in many cases, it's way more ubiquitous and more difficult to get rid of. And those are kind of different aspects of the problem. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. In terms of where I landed with this experiment and what I've been thinking about is a lot of critics are asking the question right now, the degree to which these companies are monopolies. And I really felt that with some of the blocks. Like, when I was blocking Facebook products, because Facebook owns Facebook and Instagram, they own the spaces where my community is, where all my friends are. And so I lost the ability during those weeks to communicate with my friends and share news with them and get news from them. Like, one of my friends had a baby and I didn't find out. She's one of my closest friends. And I didn't find out until days later when I turned my Facebook account back on and I called her about it. And she was like, well, I just assume if I put something on Facebook, you know, everybody will see it. But there's this question whether they're monopolies and where the antitrust scrutiny is in today's world. And I think these companies combined have bought, like, over 400 companies and startups in the last decade, and regulators in the U.S. haven't pushed back at all. It's been different in Europe. Europe has been more critical. You know, they had this big fine against Google because of the way that it bought Android, the Android operating system, which 80% of the smartphone market uses, and then said, hey, you need to bundle our apps up and put them on the phones by default. And Europe said, hey, that's troubling, right. From an antitrust standpoint. So there's the regulation question. And on the other side, there's just, like, the technologist solution, the question of why isn't there more interoperability between these platforms? Like, when you get a phone number with a certain phone carrier, you're not locked into that phone carrier right. for the rest of your life. And you can call people who have numbers with different phone carriers.
Thank God.
It's amazing, right? Like,
what a miracle.
What if AT&T and Verizon, like, if they'd just been able to lock us into their system and, like, you could only call other people who had Verizon. So there's a, so technologists are kind of like, why isn't there more, you know, technology platforms that are interoperable? Like, I want to, I don't want to be on Facebook. I'm okay to be on Pinterest. Like, can I be invited to a Facebook event? Like, technologists are saying, let's just go back to open source and make it decentralized, right, and make everything interoperable. And then the policy people are like, we need to regulate. We need to treat these companies as monopolies, and we need to ensure that we're creating a marketplace with viable competition. And so I kind of see that there's these two different paths with critics that maybe will just continue to be ignored, but who knows?
My takeaway was, in some ways, they don't act anywhere near as terribly as they could. That's what I kept thinking. The idea that Amazon has in its power, it probably would be against the law. I think it would probably be a very clear tripwire for an antitrust case if they started messing with Netflix's streaming, because they want to, you know, they want to advantage Amazon Video. But there seems to be less of that than I would have anticipated. Partly, it seems a little bit of a Clash of the Titans kind of thing. There's all these big companies. They're all more powerful than us. But they're also in fighting each other in ways that do restrain their behavior in certain ways that, as I read through your pieces, kept thinking, well, wow, you know, Google could screw over Yelp by turning off their maps, you know, if they really got into it. Like, they're not acting as predatorily as they could, I guess is my point.
Right. They could take more advantage of the power and data they have. I mean, we saw this happen very recently with Apple. I mean, Apple got mad.
Yes, exactly.
That Google and Facebook had used their kind of special all-seeing powers. They, this like corporate enterprise certificate that you're only supposed to use like with your employees, with an app that you're distributing internally. They used this power for apps that they were using to spy on research participants, including teens. And so TechCrunch reported this and people got really upset, and Apple didn't like that they'd done this. And so just overnight, they pulled, you know, this enterprise certificate. And at Facebook and Google, apparently it was complete chaos because their internal apps didn't work anymore. So they didn't, you know what was for lunch in the cafeteria, and they couldn't book a spot on like the Google and Facebook buses. and you saw how powerful it is. It was like, oh, that's a reminder. Apple controls the rails of how these things work, and they can just say,
nope,
that's not working anymore. To a certain, like when it happens in that way, it's really visible. I mean, I can't say with certainty that they haven't abused the powers that they have. The one thing I noticed in Lina Khan did this kind of like blockbuster academic paper, or blockbuster by academic standards, about how Amazon's already a monopoly. And one of the things she mentioned in it is that, you know, AWS is probably collecting valuable metadata, and it could be Amazon is always entering new industries, and it's gathering data that could be helpful to it in entering new industries. And one example of them actually using that data was that they invested in three startups that they saw, because they were hosting on AWS, that they were doing tons of traffic.
Wow.
And so they basically saw that they were having gangbusters growth, and they said, oh, we should invest in these startups.
Wow.
And so they have used the metadata from AWS in the past, and that became reported. They could have just hidden that and said, you know, we just decided to invest in these companies. I don't know how else they're using that data. And I asked Amazon about it, and they just didn't respond.
I should tell people that the series is up at Gizmodo, and you have articles, and then you have videos that are on YouTube, of course, owned by...
Well, they're on our site, they're on YouTube, they're on Facebook, they're on all these platforms I'm criticizing.
Sit there and download some Amazon Prime video of Cashmere Hill. And, you know, there's an interesting human part of those videos. Your child only likes three movies, which she can't watch during the week that you're not using Amazon because you can't stream video. Was there some kind of, for lack of a better word, spiritual lesson you learned about you as a human being and your psyche and soul in relationship to technology?
Yeah, I mean, so by blocking the tech giants, as we've talked about, they kind of control the infrastructure of so much of the web and so many other devices. So by blocking the tech giants, I block technology writ large from my life in many ways. And it was wonderful. It was the digital equivalent of going on a juice cleanse, where I just reevaluated the role of technology in my life. I deleted like stupid time wasting apps on my phone, and I turn off my phone at night, like at 8 or 9 p.m. I just like turn it off, which I used to never do. My phone would be on until the battery died, and then that would be a very traumatic event. So now I turn off my phone at night, and it's not the first thing I reach for in the morning. Whereas before I touch my husband, before I talk to my daughter, I would just pick the phone up as soon as I woke up and start scrolling through it. And I realized I actually hate that, and I don't want to start my day every day mainlining the internet through this technology that has been forced upon me by the tech giant in the world that they're creating. I don't want to look at screens as much. And I don't think we have to adopt like all the technology that's being pushed at us by, you know, these tech giants and other companies. And I think we really need to actively resist it because it's easy. It's so easy just to stare at a screen and not be where you are, not be with the people that are around you. And so I guess that was my big realization. The other, on the personal level, like during this, the last day of my block, we were flying to New York. It's a 5-hour flight from California. And we fly a lot with my daughter. And we usually just have an iPad and set her up in front of it. So in the lead up to this, my husband was like, okay, you have to end your block early. Like, we need
the iPad. Like, what's the policy there? She's not writing an article for Gizmodo. and he's like, we got to start a flight here.
He's like, it's not you using the iPad. It's me using the iPad. And I was like, no, we have to do this. I want to stay strong. And he's like, I'm moving. I'm going to sit somewhere else on the plane. And I held strong. We like reread books. That's great. Played with these like little whizzle sticks, that sticky sticks for an hour that came with her Alaska Airlines meal. She slept for the last hour and a half, which she usually doesn't do when she has an iPad to stimulate her. And we landed and we get in the taxi and my husband turns to me and he says, that was the easiest flight we've ever had.
I just threw my iPhone in the garbage here. It's done. I just tossed
Just turn it POS. Off every once in a while.
Why are you in my life? No. Kashmir Hill is an investigative reporter at Gizmodo. She just did this amazing series we were discussing about blocking the tech giants. It's such a smart conceit and it's so well conceived, and I really thank you for making the time to talk.
Thank you for popularizing it on your show. I appreciate it.